The text we're going to look at this morning is in Matthew chapter 25. It's verses 1 to 13. And it really is about Jesus' invitation to a wedding party. I gave a lesson when I was doing youth ministry, and it was called Jesus is the Life of the Party. And I wrote it on the board, and we talked about it. And then I left it on the board, and a whole bunch of older folk, other than youth, came in, and they just saw Jesus is the life of the party. And they had a lot of questions about what in the world I was talking about with their youth. But it's a lot of fun, and this is a text that talks about that in some way. So if you have your Bibles, look at Matthew chapter 25. It's on the screen, so you can just follow along there in the bulletin as well. We're going to look at verses 1 to 13. It says, "At that time, the kingdom of heaven will be like 10 virgins who took their lamps and went out to meet the bridegroom. 5 of them were foolish and 5 were wise. The foolish ones took their lamps but did not take any oil with them. The wise, however, took oil in jars along with their lamps. The bridegroom was a long time in coming, and they all became drowsy and fell asleep. At midnight, the cry rang out, 'Here's the bridegroom, come out to meet him.' Then all the virgins woke up and trimmed their lamps. The foolish one said to the wise, 'Give us some of your oil, our lamps are going out.' 'No,' they replied, 'there may not be enough for both of us and you. Instead, go to those who sell oil and buy some for yourselves.' But while they were on their way to buy the oil, the bridegroom arrived. The virgins who were ready went in with him to the wedding banquet, and the door was shut. Later the others also came. 'Sir, sir,' they said, 'open the door for us.' But he replied, 'I tell you the truth, I don't know you. Therefore keep watch, because you do not know the day or the hour.'" So if you remember the last couple weeks, we've been talking about this series of passages that's talking about Jesus returning, the coming of the kingdom. And Jesus is the king of a kingdom that he keeps talking about, that Jesus is bringing more of God's rule to earth. And all that is broken, all that is fractured, all that has fallen apart in the world, and much of that that we still experience, that we believe that Jesus came to start making all of those things right again. And so Jesus is talking about that. He's describing it as the kingdom. And so he's going through this section and talking about there will be a day when he returns and he finally makes all things right. There'll be a separation, and all the things that are broken, all the things that are fractured, all the things that are sinful will be separated from those things that have been made whole or made right through Jesus Christ, through what he has done and his work on the cross. And so this is what we're talking about in this series of passages. And honestly, they're kind of tough. And in many ways, they're pretty dark. And this is a passage that fits into that category, that there's two groups. Now, in our modern world today, when we read this text and we see the word virgin, we primarily think in sexual terms. But in the Greek, that's not at all what was meant. It just means that they're unmarried, but they're of marriageable age. So it has more to do with their age or their stage in life than has anything to do with sexuality. And so there's two groups of these women that are bridesmaids for a woman who is getting married. And Jesus tells a story about them going and being a part of this wedding procession, and half of them are ready and half of them are not. And their readiness, again, has consequences for whether or not they're welcomed into what Jesus is up to, what Jesus is doing in the world. I've had several different instances where I've been excluded in some way. Our family, and this didn't happen to me, but this is something that happened to our girls just this past week. We participated in a 4th of July party. We went over to some friend's house, and the girls were playing outside for a 4th of July party. And they were playing outside, playing on a swing set. And at one point, they saw a whole crowd of boys run into the house. And they thought, wow, that looks really fun. So they asked if they could go into the house and see what those boys were up to. So I said, sure. And so our oldest and our middle, decided to go into the house. And we let them go in the house. They go inside. And they were gone for about 5 minutes. And then they come back. And our oldest has her face like down, all dejected. And our middle, who's a little happier generally, she was kind of skipping, but you could tell that she was a little frustrated as well. And they come back, and I said, what happened? Was it not very much fun? And they said, well, we knocked on the door, and we heard them in there playing, and it sounded like the boys were having a lot of fun. And we said, can we come in? And they said, no girls allowed. No, you can't. And so they knocked some more and said, come on, let us come in and see. And they turned around, and they walked out. And I think all of us have some sort of experience like that, right? Where we wanted to do something that was really exciting and really fun, but we were rejected in some way. When I was in college, my freshman year, the fun thing was to go find parties that were a lot of fun. And a lot of those parties somehow had some exclusion, right? Only certain people were allowed into them, especially fraternity, sorority parties. And I can remember one time in college that I had a friend that was in town, and I was going to show him a good time and be really, really cool. And I go up, and, you know, the problem is I didn't know anybody at the party. So I said, hey, my friend Mark told me to come over. We're from out of town, so I didn't have a chance to get on the list. And sure enough, we were rejected and turned away. In Chicago, all the time, there was, when we would ride the L, I'd ride the L downtown to work, there was the opportunity to go ahead of time and buy your ticket, and you could just go ahead and swipe your card and get on the train. The other option was to use the machine right by the train station and buy your ticket immediately, take it, and get on the train. Well, the problem was if you waited to buy your ticket right before you got on the train and there was a huge line, then you would be waiting in line while that train went by and you would have missed it. And so you can think of examples in your life of those times when it matters whether or not you're prepared or whether or not you're ready. And so last week, if you remember, the text that we talked about was about a master and servants. And the story was that the servants were basically fooling around, and the master came back from a trip early and caught them doing things that they weren't supposed to do because they didn't expect him to come back early. This week, we have really the opposite scenario, where the problem isn't that the master or the groom comes back early. The problem is that they expected him to come earlier. And because he came later, they weren't prepared for the long delay. So let's talk about the story in particular, what's happening. It seems a little odd to us because we don't do weddings this way today. But in the ancient world, and still in some parts of the world, they do a similar thing to what happens in this text. They do a wedding procession. And I actually have a picture here. This is a picture of a wedding procession in Macedonia that is in current day. And this would have been somewhat like the scene that you can imagine in this text. Basically, the tradition was that the groom would go to the bride's house. Usually the bride was living with her parents. He would go to the bride's house, and he would gather the bride and her attendants, and he would have his own group that was going with him. He'd go from his house, and he'd process to the bride's house. And he would take the bridesmaids and all of his folks, and they would all process together all the way back to the groom's house. And the ceremony might take place there, some sort of party might take place there, but it was a multi-day affair. And so in this text, what you can picture is the bridesmaids, the women that are attending to the bride that's going to get married, are standing outside, most likely the bride's parents' house, and they're waiting there with torches. In the ancient world, especially in poor communities, it wasn't necessarily a lantern, but it might have just been a stick with a rag tied around it with oil, and it would have been lit on fire. And so that's why it would have been important to have more oil, so that if the oil burned out, then you can add more oil to it. But they were standing outside the bride's house waiting for the groom, and when the groom was seen, then they would notify the bride, "Here he is. He's come for you," and then they would go ahead and process. And it was likely in the middle of the night. Sometimes these went late into the night. Sometimes midnight or later in the ancient world without any electricity, without any lights. And so the scene here is these bridesmaids, these women, are outside the bride's house, and they're waiting for the groom. And it said there are two sets of women. They're all going out to do the same thing. It said, but some bring extra oil, and the others don't. And so what happens is the groom is coming, and someone notifies them that he's on his way, and they hear, he's a short distance away. And the women who did not bring oil, at this time they're all sleeping. You notice all of them sleep. It wasn't just some of them sleep. They're all sleeping. And the text says that the women that did not bring enough oil recognize that they don't have enough oil, not only to welcome the groom, but likely also to process all the way back to the groom's house. And so they say, "We don't have enough oil. Give us some of your oil." And the other bridesmaids say, "Well, we won't then have enough for the procession." And so the result is that these women without enough oil decide that they're going to go into town and they're going to have to buy more oil, and then they'll come back. And it says that when they come back, the groom has already come and they've missed him. And so they decide, well, we've missed him. Let's go and find his house. They knock on the door, and it says that the groom says, I don't know you. And the door has already been shut, and they are shut outside of this party, of the wedding banquet. They're locked out. And so Jesus is using this to talk about the kingdom. And honestly, we don't like these types of passages because they have finality to them. They have judgment to them. We like to think that there's always another chance. There's always another opportunity. But we also know that there are lots of instances in our life where that is certainly not the case as well. We may not like them, but it's true. Our death is obviously one. There's one chance at death. You will die one time. And there's finality in that death. And so these passages are hard for us, but they're an important part of what Jesus is saying about how important what it is he's talking about really is. And so in this passage, Jesus is separating the wise from the unwise, or the silly from the prepared. He's saying that those women that had oil, that were ready, no matter how long it took for the groom to come, that they were prepared, that they were wise. And the ones that were not ready, they were silly or they were unwise. And he's calling us to be like those that are wise, those that are prepared. And so in a broad sense, the theme is exactly like what it was that Jesus was saying last week and what we talked about. And Jesus is in a section where he's pounding home this point that you and I, as followers of Jesus, are to be ready, prepared. That we're to persevere no matter what the circumstances of life are. That we're to be alert and watchful. But there's something else kind of interesting in this passage. What separates the wise from the unwise is the delay. Notice that there would be no difference if the groom showed up at his anticipated or expected time. Both of the women would have been prepared. Both sets of women would have been prepared. The ones that brought hardly any fuel or any oil, and those that brought a whole bunch. But what separates the two and helps us to see who is wise and unwise is the fact that a delay happens. Something unexpected happens. That there's some sort of interruption. And so I think there's a good lesson for us in that. That really what pounds home whether or not we're faithful or whether or not we're prepared or whether or not we're wise or unwise isn't those things that we can prepare for. It's not this hour and 15 minutes or this hour on Sunday morning when you're here. It may not even be your small group time. It may not even be the Bible study time. That's not really the test of our faithfulness. The test of our faithfulness are those unexpected things that happen to us. Those things that come out of left field, those delays, those frustrations. And the test is, how do we react in those circumstances? What do we find we're feeling, or what do we find that we're thinking when the unexpected happens? Is there a foundation there that provides the opportunity for us to react in whatever way we can? I've talked a little about this in the past, but I read a book one time on improv comedy. And if you, improv comedy, you know, they'll just go up and the crowd will, if you've ever been to one of those shows, the crowd will just yell out words and they'll do a whole sketch on a random word that the crowd yells out. And it's fascinating and hilarious to watch when done well. It's actually horrible and scary if it's not done well. You just feel really sorry for the people up there. But when it's done well, it's amazing. And so this book was all about how folks that are really good at improv comedy do it, because most of us look upon that and say, wow, they're really, really good at being completely unprepared and not ready. And what the book was all about is it's actually the complete opposite. What they're trained to do is be prepared and ready for anything that may come out from the audience. And so there's a way in our faith that is similar to that. That when we are grounded in God's Word, when we're grounded in conversation with God in prayer, when we're grounded in hanging out with other folks that are trying to follow Jesus like we are, there's a way that that prepares us, or there's a way that that makes us ready, that no matter what happens in life, no matter what tragedy befalls us, or no matter what brokenness that we encounter, that our reaction will be grounded in God's truth, that our reaction will come out in a faithful way. And so when we ask, how are we doing? Are we wise? Are we faithful? Are we persevering? Review your week, review your month, and ask, when things happen to me, when the guy at the post office butts in line in front of me, when someone cheats me or is unfair to me, when a coworker stabs me in the back, when my spouse does something that I don't like or asks me to do something that makes me feel like I'm their servant, think about those instances and ask, what is my reaction to those? What comes out of me? What is the overflow of my life in those circumstances? And we find then, are we prepared? Are we ready? That's what separates in this passage the wise from the unwise. Now, there's a couple passages also in the Bible that is very similar to what we find in this section. One is in Luke chapter 13. And both of these passages, are very hard texts. Hard texts in the sense that they're not really hard to understand, but they're hard because they're hard on us, that they're clear, they're harsh. So Luke 13 says, make every effort to enter through the narrow door, because many, I tell you, will try to enter and will not be able to. Once the owner of the house gets up and closes the door, you will stand outside knocking and pleading, sir, open the door for us. But he will answer, I don't know you or where you come from. Then you will say, we ate and drank with you, and you taught in our streets. But he will reply, I don't know you or where you come from. Away from me, all you evildoers. And we find that same language that we find in this passage in verse 25 where he says, I do not know you. I don't know where you came from. You're claiming to know who I am, which is fine and dandy, but I don't know who you are. Same thing happens in Matthew chapter 7. This was early. We covered this several months ago when we were going through Matthew earlier. Not everyone who says to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven, but only the one who does the will of my Father who is in heaven. Many will say to me on that day, Lord, Lord, did we not prophesy in your name, and in your name drive out demons, and in your name perform many miracles? Then I will tell them plainly, I never knew you. Away from me, you evildoers. I believe, as I read through Matthew, this is the hardest passage. That Matthew 7 is the hardest passage that I read in Matthew. That it's really the harshest, the clearest, that Jesus often is with folks. And he says that lots of people are going to come up to me and say, I knew you. I said Jesus, you know, he was in the Bible. I knew he was in there. I knew that catchphrase that we're supposed to say as followers of Jesus, that Jesus died on the cross. I know those facts. I could say those things about you. In this text, it even says that people said they prophesied in Jesus' name. They might have even cast out demons or performed many miracles, these super holy things that they're making claims to. Yet Jesus is saying when they come up and they give this laundry list of things that they did in his name, well, those things are really fine and dandy, but I never knew you. I never knew you. When I think about this, I think about the context of what it might be like in our world to have a really famous person that we're going around and bragging to all their friends that we know. Like, take LeBron James or someone like that. You can go to all your friends and say, I know LeBron James. I know that he plays for the Miami Heat, and I know what he looks like, and I know what his number is, and I know he won a championship, and I know all these facts about him. And I can tell you about what he's done and where he went to high school, and I can tell you all this stuff about him. But when the rubber hits the road, the question is, when you go up to LeBron James with your buddies, is he going to have a clue who you are? Have you spent time with him? And so there's a way that Jesus talks about a relationship with him that is not about information. It's not about facts. It's not even about sitting in a chair on Sunday morning. It's about whether or not we have a relationship with him. It's about whether or not we're getting to know him. And we're allowing him to get to know us. At Riverside, we talk about authenticity. We say we want to be a church that is authentic. I stand up here and I tell you lots of things that I've screwed up in my life. I try to be authentic to you, that I make mistakes all the time in my marriage, and I do really dumb things in parenting my kids, and I make mistakes all the time. And so the point isn't trying to be perfect or being able to do everything exactly how we ought to. The point is, am I in relationship with a Jesus, with a God who I believe is working in me and transforming me and making me new? Is making beautiful things out of us. And Jesus says ultimately that will be the test of whether or not he knows us in the end. Have we spent time with him? Chatting with him? Talking about him with friends and learning about him and his word, and not just as information, but as relationship. So that he knows us. The reality of these texts is that the judgment is fairly clear, and it's certainly harsh and difficult. But Jesus is saying there will be a day when I come and I complete the work that I have finished. He's been saying this for several chapters, that he is beginning a work. God is beginning a work in the world when Jesus comes, when God puts on flesh as Jesus, that new things begin to happen, and that we believe that we can have new life through our belief in Jesus. But there's a day that is coming when Jesus will return and all that is broken in this world will be over. And there'll be a separation between those that have preferred the brokenness of this world and those that prefer the kingdom, the new life, the regeneration through Jesus. And there's finality to that. The door literally is, in this passage, is shut. Because Jesus is saying and predicting that there will be an end to the brokenness. And we're either going to be a part of the newness or we're going to be a part of the brokenness. And there's really no way to skirt around that. And so Jesus' call to us is to be a part of the newness. To be prepared, to be ready, to bring our full selves to him in this life so that we might experience the wholeness and the newness of the kingdom and the new creation. We've gone through a section of a whole bunch of hard passages, and I've done this before, but it usually makes people really awkward and they don't ever participate. But we have some time, and I thought I would just ask, in this section, or even really through Matthew, moving right along. We're in the mid-20s now in Matthew. We only have a few weeks, a month or so to go. I was just going to ask whether anyone has anything that God has been doing in them or any questions that have arisen through these texts, and we could talk about those. If no one has any questions, well, maybe I shouldn't say this because you're all going to say, I don't have any questions because I want to go home. But if we don't, then I'm going to pray for us and we'll go. But we have time this morning, and I'd love to hear if anybody has any thoughts or questions that have arisen from any of these texts, because they're hard. So if you do, raise your hand. Or even if you have some insights that you want to share, maybe you can explain it better than I can. Yeah.
Have you ever read anything on Matthew and where it came from and what it was about?
The Gospel of Matthew? Yeah, like the writer of Matthew? Yeah. So Matthew was he's writing to a Jewish audience. He was a Jew. And he had a radical transformation following Jesus. And so he is writing, a lot of we know about Matthew is he's writing to an audience that is Jewish. And so that's why we get a lot of language where he's explaining to the Jewish people what it is that Jesus is as the Messiah that they long anticipated. And so, I don't know if that answers your question, but we have some biographical information about him as a tax collector that was converted to follow Jesus, but he understood, as Jesus preached, that Jesus was the Messiah that had been anticipated in the long Jewish history.